You're listening to Out of Bounds with Daily Bruin Sports here on UCLAradio.com. Daily Bruin Sports is your ultimate source for UCLA athletics, and Out of Bounds provides you with an in-depth look at the UCLA sports scene like nobody else can. Here are your hosts, Andrew Erickson, Kevin Bowman, and Jason Dranch.
It is late on a Wednesday night here in the Ackerman studios. I am Daily Bruin Sports senior staffer now. I get to officially use the senior staffer title. Andrew Erickson, and I'm joined by...
Kevin Bowman, Daily Bruin Sports editor. I get to officially do that now.
Cool. Yeah, so it was quite an adventure getting on the radio show today. We were locked out of the office, but persistence got us here, and thanks to Sid Shaw and Jason Dranch and Bianca Brogius, we are now on the air, broadcasting to all of you live. So Kevin, talk to me a little bit about how your summer's been going, and have you been keeping up with the sports world?
Yeah, it's been going pretty well. It's been kind of relaxing, kind of pressing out at the same time too, trying to find some stuff to put in the paper over the summer, but it's been all fun. It's definitely keeping up on the stuff. We had a pretty exciting run by baseball a couple weeks ago.
Exactly. Yeah, let's jump right into baseball. They, of course, won title number 109 for UCLA just this past week. They defeated the Mississippi State Bulldogs in two games in the best of three series there. Kevin, what was your impression of this team's run, especially towards the end of the College World Series when, you know, really they didn't have the offense that a national championship caliber team should have, but were still able to get it done?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty incredible, I think, just not only the fact that their offense wasn't there, but the fact that the teams they were going against had some of the best offensive teams in the nation, and they were able to just completely shut them down. And they made UCLA made their own offense look better than their opponents, despite being like ranked 200 spots below them in every single category, basically. So it was just pretty incredible, just showing how well managed the game was by John Savage, how well executed it was by the players, and just really it was pretty a flawless playoff run by them.
Yeah, John Savage, who just recently turned down, think about a $1 million per year offer from USC.
Yeah, that's what LA Times is saying.
To stay at UCLA. So he's a Bruin in the near future. And talk to me a little bit about the pitching staff. I know it seemed like early on, Adam Plutko kind of went through this postseason with kind of a chip on his shoulder in the first round of the draft, or the first day of the draft, rather. It was the opening game of the Super Regional against Cal State Fullerton, and he doesn't go in the first seven or eight rounds of the draft, and he has to pitch that night. I mean, it must have taken kind of a Herculean effort to really shut down the Titans, or the Tritons, rather. Titans, sorry, in that game.
One of them.
Yeah, one of them. Yeah, I got it right the first time. To shut him down in that game, and really... The pitching was flawless from this team in the postseason. What most impressed you, I guess, with the pitching staff?
Well, I don't know. I think it's just an all-around thing. Like, the starters all did really well. I think most any starter gave up was one run. David Byrd being able to... I think he pitched every single game in the College World Series, at least,
right,
and a couple in the rest of the postseason as well. Like, he'd get himself in a jam sometimes. He wasn't completely brilliant, but he'd always find a way to get out of it. Like, any great closer has to add some drama at the end of the game. Look at Brian Wilson, his entire career, has to load the bases and then get out of it. I think Byrd really channeled that. Plutko, as you mentioned, he was supposed to go. I think Keith Law on ESPN had him ranked like 66 or something.
Right.
He didn't get drafted until the 11th round. And so he came out and pitched a great game against Fullerton in the Super Regional. During the post-game interview, he was in tears and stuff, but he fought through it. And I think it's just an amazing performance by all the pitchers.
And of course, you know, Vanderteigen and Watson. I think Watson only pitched once in the College World Series, and
yeah,
correct me if I'm wrong, but they rarely use Caprillion in the College World Series. But really, in the near future, I guess, at least from a bullpen perspective, you have guys that are returning. I know Plutko, it's not certain whether he'll sign or not. Vanderteigen may sign. Looks like Zach Weiss may sign, but
I think Weiss already did. I think.
Weiss did.
Along
with Brenton Allen, but you're going to have guys like Caprillion's going to be back, Berg's going to be back, and really the back end of this bullpen that really bolstered this team's success because they were so consistent, that whole unit will be back.
Yeah, one thing with Caprillion I'm interested in seeing is he was brought in, he was supposed to be the closer this year. He started up
right, the
season as a closer, and then Berg took over, and I feel like Caprillion's a little overqualified just to be a setup man. I could see him maybe being shifted to a starter next year because he has some really great stuff. I'm not sure about his stamina and whatever, if he can last that many innings, but stuff-wise, he's really great, and I think he could definitely has a lot of potential as a starter.
Yeah, I remember in
that'd be interesting.
In just the second game, I think it was, I know, it was actually the first game of the Super Regional when they were playing against Fullerton, and they brought in extras. I think they brought in Berg for a 5 or 6 out save, and it was right after they had Caprillion in for, I think, 1 or 2 batters, and they took Caprillion out, and after the game, Savage said, you know, no offense to James, he has electric stuff. We have a blindside, and with us now to present this blindside, he's back, he's in Los Angeles, he's the man of the city, Daily Bruin sports reporter, Jason Dranch.
Hey guys, I got a bit of a fever right now, and it's called Puig Mania, all right?
I thought you were well, Jason. I didn't think you were sick. I'm so sorry to hear that.
I'm glad I can't get contaminated. You were just over phone. It's good.
I got Puig Mania. So what I'm blindsiding with you guys with this week is Yasiel Puig going to keep up this incredible start he's had to his career?
Well, Jason, if you were watching the game today, you saw that Yasiel Puig was actually taken out of the game. I believe he banged himself against the wall in
Colorado.
Is it Coors Field? And they have a chain link fence that's right next to the wall, and he crashed into that. It might be just a contusion, it might be just a bruise, but based on today alone, I'm going to say no. He's been unbelievable up to this point. I think he's batting something like 440, and has had a number of 3-hit games and the likes of that. But I think if you look at what happened tonight, then possibly no.
Yeah, I don't know. I remember you asking us about him like second to last show we had at the quarter, and I had no idea who he was.
I had no idea.
And I don't know. I know where he is now. He's made himself well-known with, like, batting, I think, like, a 448 or something. It's an incredible number. Obviously, he's not going to bat 440 for the entire season. I'm assuming he's not, unless he's, like, a sweet, amazing player. He's the best person ever. But, I mean, I can't see him keeping that up, but I still think he's going to have a solid year. I can't see him dropping below, like, 300 or so. But he could. I mean, he's going to cool off. Everyone goes through hot and cold stretches, but He's definitely proven himself as a very capable MLB player.
Right, and if he keeps getting in fights with Ian Kennedy, then who knows what'll happen to his season.
All right, well, the x-ray came back negative, and he was diagnosed with a bruised left hip and a muscle of his thigh. So he's day-to-day right now, but I think he'll come back strong and continue this hot streak, so we'll see.
And we of course, suspended this for the last week, thinking that, you know, there's no way we're going to be doing a podcast this summer. There's no way we're going to be doing anything till the fall. So let's just suspend all punishments. But no, we were wrong. So you know what we need to do? We need to bring back the You Better Be Right. And of course, who better to present You Better Be Right and to give us our topic than the man, the myth, the legend, Daily Bruin sports reporter, Jason Dranch.
All right, so continuing our MLB theme here tonight, what I want to know from you guys, next time we have a podcast, who's going to be the team with the better record? The Los Angeles Dodgers or the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim? And I can't believe I just said that.
Well, I got to look at the stats on this one first. I don't even know what their records are.
They're very similar. I think it's within a game of each other.
Dodgers are now 40-43, and then the Angels were 40-43 pending tonight's results.
I don't know. I'm going to have to go to the Dodgers, I think. Just, if Puig is able to get back just the way he's been able to play, I think it's going to give the team new life. I don't know if Hanley Ramirez has been out, but I saw that he's played again recently. If
he's
going to get healthy, I think
strong.
That team is going to start doing things, especially with Puig hitting well. I'll go with the Dodgers in this.
And by nature of disagreeing with Kevin automatically, I will go with the Angels. They are technically my team, but I'm really nervous about this pick just because I don't trust the back end of their bullpen. Frieri, I don't know what that Ephus pitch he throws, but it's not been working out too well for him. And you can really see the lack of Torii Hunter in this offense. But really, when you get going, when Josh Hamilton decides he wants to hit the ball, Albert Pujols is hitting well. Of course, Mike Trout and Mark Trumbo. We have this guy Shuck now. I had never heard of him before, like 2 weeks ago, but he's hitting really well. Howie Kendrick and Eric Ibar are always solid members of the lineup, but yeah, I guess I'm saying the Angels will have a better record. And CJ Wilson, who I will actually be seeing on Friday night, seems to be pitching better as well. So I'm going to go with the Angels.
Good luck with that one.
And Jason, you know, I know you're on campus. You've been on campus a lot recently, but I noticed that you've been kind of getting into this Dwight Howard thing. You know, stay D12. I think you did. You see him or no? Did you not see him at the student activity center the other day?
I personally didn't see him. I saw photos of him in SAC. I was in class when the photos were, you know, put online on Twitter, and so I couldn't make it down until about 40 minutes after the photos were posted. By that time, he was gone.
Crushing yeah. Loss. I'm sorry.
But I heard he's working out with Stephen Curry's brother. Is that what you tweeted?
No, he's working out with Steph Curry.
Oh, I thought you said Seth. Hmm.
I rescinded that tweet. I was in class, okay? It was fast thinking. I wrote the wrong name, okay? I know you like the joke with me, Kevin, but it was an error. I accept it.
I'll forgive you eventually.
But yeah, he's been on campus several times. This isn't the first time in the last 2 weeks that he's been here. He was here reportedly with Kevin Love and Ricky Rubio last week. And my professor for one of my classes, he said he was getting out of his car the other day and Dwight Howard was right next to him getting in his car. So he's definitely been around campus.
I think that he's headed to Houston just because they have a pretty decent chance of winning with Chandler Parsons and James Harden. I think that would be a decent trio, at least for them, and Omer Asik if they can keep him. I also think he likes the fact that there's no state taxes in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And he also must like the fact that Slim Thug is tweeting at him, telling him a number of reasons why he should stay. No, reasons I won't mention on this show, yeah. Just for sake of, you know, the FCC not coming after us. But, you know, I really think he's headed to Houston. I don't know what your thoughts are, Kevin, but I don't think Golden State has.
There were some reports on Twitter today that he was very enamored, or he was very impressed with Golden State's pitch that they gave him. It makes a lot of sense, like, on paper. I think Dwight Howard's a very religious man, and obviously Mark Jackson, Warriors coach, is a preacher. So that pairing makes sense. Him and Steph Curry, I feel, would be an incredible match or pairing, just with the pick and rolls and Steph's little, like, runner lob thing could be great as, like, alley-oops. It would make a lot of sense. The only problem is that the only way they can get him is with a sign-and-trade with the Lakers, and the Lakers, an in-conference division rival of the Warriors, and they're not going to want to trade with them and give up their players. They're not going to want to face Dwight four times a year. Yeah. So I see him going to Houston, too, as much as I'd love for him to come to Oakland.
Yeah, and I think the kind of to sum up how Dwight Howard has played in the past few years is Dwight Howard plays as well as Dwight Howard wants to play. And
yeah,
so regardless of what team he plays for, it's the team's success is going to be relying upon his motivation. And I think if he really likes James Harden, who's kind of a soft-spoken guy, and Dwight can really be that number one guy, then you have yourself a deal. So, Jason, thank you so much for being on with us, and we'll have you back later in the show. But right now we're going to shift right back into baseball a little bit. And I know I was talking about James Caprillion before we were thrown off guard. We were blindsided by Jason Dranch. But I agree with you, Kevin. I think Caprillion has the stuff to be a starter. He certainly throws hard enough. And if he can, you know, be consistent, stretch himself out through an entire game, I think that, you know, the loss of Vanderteig potentially won't be so crushing.
Yeah, definitely. You said it all there. Caprillion does the great stuff. Vanderteig and Puck are most likely gone. So there's people need to step up and fill that void, and I think Caprillion can definitely do it.
And one of the questions I had, I know he was drafted by the Brewers in the 30-something round, but Ryan Dieter, who is the setup man most of last year and was an outstanding player, really we didn't see much of him this year. I know he had the iconic glasses. He was on, you know, some bus advertisements for UCLA, but he really didn't make too many appearances out of the bullpen. It was mostly Zach Weiss, Caprillion, and of course Berg. But from your expertise covering this team, where did Dieter go?
I mean, maybe he just went to the library to study. he got named one of the, like, he won some award given to
that's right, yeah,
the best student athlete at each NCAA finals thing. So he's apparently a genius because that was in, like, a science major or something too. So he's really smart. As for playing time, I don't really know. He didn't pitch a lot when I was covering the team. I started in the beginning of April, and from then on, I saw him pitch like maybe four or five times total, if that. I mean, he didn't blow me away with anything he had. He didn't stand out in any way when I saw him, bad or good. I guess, I mean, he's his fourth year there too, so Savage has to kind of trust him, but I guess
right.
He had more faith in some younger guys going into the playoffs, I guess.
And one of my last questions, you know, and last thing we can discuss is, we talked about the team's really low batting average of something around .227 in the College World Series and .250 on the season, but how did the layout of TD Ameritrade, it seemed like I think it was the game against NC State where towards the end of the game, they had, I think, two runners on, and this guy just hit an absolute rocket off his bat. Maybe went, you know, close to 400 feet into the gap, but I think it was, well, who had replaced...
That was Berg that was pitching.
Yeah, that was Berg that was pitching.
Yeah,
and there was an over-the-shoulder catch, and that ball easily would have been out at UCLA or Northridge or wherever they're playing on the West Coast, but somehow the layout of TD Ameritrade, and Oral Hershiser was very quick to point out kind of how fortunate UCLA's playing style was given the dimensions of the ballpark. But, I mean, really, they kind of lucked out.
Yeah, I think definitely it was a huge factor. That's one thing I think the NCAA or the College World Series wants to make a lot of look into, just because it favors pitching teams so much that there's all these great hitting teams. I think I know LSU got a home run off UCLA,
right?
But that's the only one. There was maybe four other balls hit throughout the postseason or throughout the College World Series against the Bruins that probably should have gone out in any other stadium that didn't. And given how close all their games were, that could be like deciding factors there. So definitely being able to reliance and their knowledge to play small ball, not trying to hit it out like their opponents did, really kind of helped them. It was just a huge stadium, and it was just too hard to get the ball out. I think the winds were blowing towards the plate, too, and just knocking everything down. So definitely the layout of the stadium helped the Bruins a lot.
And former Daily Bruins sports editor and sports superstar Sam Strong actually tweeted at us and said that it was Christoph Bono, the defensive replacement for Brenton Allen, that made the catch. So thank you, Sam.
We hope
you're enjoying the show. And also I've been to Rosenblatt, the former, you know, venue where the College World Series was hosted, and it's an absolute launching pad. And that was also when they were using the aluminum bats that had a ridiculous amount of pop. Now they've switched to a BB core system, both for safety and to help them resemble more of a wood bat feel. But you can see how the bats have just been deadened. It's not the same ping sound as before, and it makes sense why these balls aren't going as far.
Yeah, it really, I mean, I don't know if it took away from the game, but just the fact that offense was just so removed from everything, that it was just a pitching and defensive game for every single team, it kind of took away a bit from the whole baseball experience. That's one weapon of the game. Offense couldn't really be, exploited if you have a good offense, I guess is the word.
Yeah. Well, we'll see if they'll repeat next year. It seems like offensively it's only up from this point, but, you know, I guess this year goes to show us that it's really your pitching and maybe not your offense all the time that wins championships. So we'll take a quick break right now, and we'll be right back with more Out of Bounds on Daily Bruin Radio. And welcome back to Out of Bounds on Daily Bruin Radio. Kevin, I don't know if you were paying attention these past couple weeks to what's going on in Oakland, but on June 20th, we had Ed O'Bannon and a number of advocates for athletes, as well as the NCAA, who is a defendant, co-defendant in this case. They were in Oakland, and they were hearing their cases heard by Judge Claudia Wilkins. And this could be a major, major change, I guess, for the shape of NCAA sports to come.
Yeah, I've been following this a little bit. It sounds like a pretty crazy lawsuit that if stuff goes happens with it, I mean, it could really change the whole entire landscape of college sports.
Yeah, and of course, this wasn't the actual case of O'Bannon versus the NCAA, but it was more of a hearing to decide whether this class action lawsuit is feasible. The actual trial, if there is one, won't take place for over a year, but it's important to UCLA fans out there because Ed O'Bannon was, of course, a player on UCLA's last national title-winning basketball team in 1995, and he apparently was playing an NCAA, or frequently plays NCAA basketball games, and likes to, you know, press R1 and L1 and go to those historic rosters, and he saw the 1995 roster for UCLA and was a little upset to see, you know, a player of his likeness, of that looked exactly like Ed O'Bannon, had the exact same attributes as Ed O'Bannon, but he didn't have his name on it. He didn't make any money from it. And it seemed like the NCAA and EA Sports were using his likeness and were trying to fix, and in general are trying to fix, the price of a student athlete's likeness at zero. And that's kind of the basis for the lawsuit. Although it was something that was only discussed for maybe about 15 minutes in the actual proceedings that took place.
It's definitely something that, I mean, EA, who's making a lot of these games, can go and claim that, oh, it's not, the athletes are just using generic names and random attributes and stuff. But, I mean, everyone kind of knows what's going on with these things. Like, I mean, you can tell when Alabama has some great players, like, you know who it is. It's not like they're fooling anyone by, like, having generic names or just halfback number 7 or whatever it is on people's jerseys.
Right. And if you go back and play NCAA 03 and you go and be, you know, you decide to play as USC, you know that HB number 5 is Reggie Bush. Like, that's a given. Or right now, or in the past couple of games, if you play as QB number 16, as I frequently do because I'm a Michigan fan, that it's Denard Robinson. And I actually did a story on the NCPA, which is the National Collegiate Players Association, which started right here at UCLA. And I asked Brett Hundley for the story, kind of, you know, when he turns on these games, does he know who QB number 17 is, like, and how he feels about that? And he, you know, didn't really have much to offer in terms of how he feels, but he said, you know, I know it's me. I know Marcus Mariota is Marcus Mariota, and I know DeAnthony Thomas is DeAnthony Thomas. So really, it's if they can get the class action lawsuit to stick, they really have a case, because Brett Hundley's obviously not pocketing any money from, you know, his player or QB number 17 being in the game. And it seems like, obviously, EA Sports is doing very well for itself, and the NCAA is, of course. So they have a case if it sticks, but it's just a matter of will the lawsuit hold, and will it be classified as a class action lawsuit?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting case, too, just thinking of the implicator, the ramifications it could have. When you think of, for EA at least, making video games, I'm not going to want to buy a game that just has random players in it.
Right.
It's like, so, I mean, if they're going to want to keep on making this product and making a lot of money off of it, they're going to want to get those players in it. And to get those players, it sounds like if this lawsuit goes through and O'Bannon's side wins, they would need to get the college players to get compensation, which would completely force the NCAA to change every single law that they have regarding athlete compensation. And just everything in sports that we know would change.
Yeah, and the suggestion they came back with, or the judge, I guess, came back with, was that the plaintiffs need to be more, if they want to cast a wider net, I guess, with their lawsuit, they need to have more current NCAA athletes. And my thought is, because the NCPA, it was started by Ramogi Huma, who is a former linebacker on the UCLA football team. I think he played back in the late 90s and early 2000s. Because of UCLA's representation in this group, and because they've constantly been a group that's been fighting for student-athlete rights, that they will be the ones to potentially jump into this case. You know, and that's purely speculation, but who knows? We could be seeing a Brett Hundley or a Kyle Anderson or somebody like that jumping into this case and being one of the plaintiffs and who goes and attacks the NCAA. The problem is, you know, I think with student athletes is they're afraid of being, you know, criticized by the NCAA or not being allowed to play if they go against them in a lawsuit, which I guess is kind of a legitimate fear. And the interesting thing is, you see, you know, if you walk into UCLA student store, the number 15 basketball jersey is being sold. And as far as we know, Shabazz Muhammad isn't profiting from that at all. And we all know who number 15 is. Back in the day when, of course, I said I'm a Michigan fan, the Fab Five was very popular. They had Fab Five sneakers that were being sold by Nike. So clearly there are firms and there are entities that are making money off these transactions. And it's not the players necessarily. I mean, in some cases, you know, we've had agents providing players with illegal benefits. But I think an environment in which there's so much money being made, but it's not being made by the players, kind of fosters these relationships between athletes and agents. And I think maybe that's something that won't continue as much. Well, or it could be worse. You could have agents coming into the high schools and middle schools and started recruiting players early. But if you kind of regulate the amount of endorsements these kids can get and make it so that, you know, if a star player wants to provide for his family, he can, then, you know, potentially you could be changing the athlete-agent relationship.
Yeah, I mean, it just has a lot of things can happen. I think if they do change stuff, it's just going to open an entire Pandora's box of possibilities and what could happen. Like, they talked with the agents, players. I mean, you see stuff now in college basketball. Like, a few years ago, Enes Kanter was on Kentucky. He wasn't allowed to play at all because apparently he played professionally overseas. Stuff like that wouldn't be happening anymore, just because they're allowed to do endorsements, they can play professionally. Maybe that would happen. I don't know. But I mean, that kind of stuff. You mentioned with the agents, endorsement stuff, where players are getting endorsement deals before. I mean, that could open up problems too. If like schools at UCLA who are endorsed by Adidas, I think,
right,
sponsored by them. If a player like in high school signs a deal with Nike and then tries to sign with UCLA, that could just cause problems, stuff like that. It raises a lot of issues that will be interesting to see how this gets resolved.
Yeah, and to a certain extent, you could almost argue that not being able to get those endorsements almost contributes to a one-and-done system. Would Derrick Rose, if he's able to sign with Adidas right before he enters Memphis, would he stay for another year, possibly, you know, try to avenge his national title game loss? Who knows?
Yeah, but that makes a lot of sense, yeah.
Right. You know, something like stipends, they've been considered in the past. I think in 2012, the NCAA and, you know, their president, Mark Emmert, tried to implement a stipend of $2,000 per year per school, per athlete. I'm going to use a lot of pers here. But that's something that failed, and it's partially because not every school is really on board with this. At a school like UCLA, there's money from the boost, whether it's from the boosters or just in general, to pay for this because their revenues are so high. I think in 2011 and 2012, UCLA brought in $25 million for football and another $8 million for basketball. And that doesn't even tap into the money that they started earning at the end of 2012 with the Pac-12 network. So really, the money's there if they want to implement a stipend system, at least at UCLA. But the problem, I guess, and that's why this failed with the NCAA, is that not every school would really be on board.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense. If you think about it, like a team like Notre Dame that has a ton of, they have their games on TV every single week, and then someone
on
like
NBC,
Washington,
yeah,
State, they're not making the same amount of money for the NCAA or for their own programs. So if you give every player or every school the same stipend, I mean, the players are all working, potentially, or hypothetically, they'd be working the same amount of, putting the same amount of effort in and whatnot. But, I mean, Notre Dame's obviously still getting a lot more profit out of it than a team or a school like Washington State would. So it causes a lot of problems like that, where just the imbalance of, I mean, if something like this happens, you'd have to do something like the NFL does with
revenue sharing.
Revenue sharing, yeah. Where something that, I mean, it just opens up a whole realm of possibilities that it's impossible to think about right now. And so, well, it's easy to think about. It's impossible to predict what would happen just because so much depends on the NCAA's current non-endorsement kind of system.
Right.
Or non-paying system.
And in California, it's actually something that could change pretty soon here, because there's actually a bill that's going, I believe it's in committee right now. It's Assembly Bill 475, which was made by Assemblywoman Cheryl Brown, I believe. And what that says is that schools that are making over $20 million in media revenues in the state of California, which is aimed at specifically USC, UCLA, Cal, and Stanford, and potentially San Diego State in the future, they'd have to make a little bit more. But it would mandate them to give student-athletes stipends of $3,600 per year. And, you know, I asked her staff about this, and they said that obviously California law would supersede NCAA law, because the NCAA is just, you know, an athletic institution. It's not, you know, a legal institution that people are bound to follow. So you might raise the case that the NCAA, if these states are willing to pass these student-athlete bills of rights more frequently, that the NCAA kind of loses some of its power.
Yeah, I mean, it's another tricky situation there, just because if California passes this, does that mean that these things only, like the NCAA would have to change its rules somewhat, but would those only apply in California, or would that be nationwide? And it's just, I don't know, the NCAA it needs a lot of reforms already without this, because they have their own issues and stuff, but this just kind of, this whole lawsuit just puts a lot more pressure on the NCAA to look at their whole, I don't know, it's not a constitution, but whatever, their whole like rulebook thing to figure out
right
things that it can fix, because obviously there's lots broken right now.
Yeah, and you obviously mentioned that there's a lot that's up in the air. You know, how invested is Ed O'Bannon? He kind of seemed out of his element maybe a little bit when he was in the courtroom. That's not really his thing. I don't know how strongly he really feels about this, or if he's just been made the poster child. Will current student athletes be kind of thrown into the fray? How much money will students end up getting, and to what extent will universities have to share their revenues? And these are all, you know, a bunch of huge questions, but really the one thing that's not in question is that this was a really, really bad year for the NCAA. They completely screwed up on the Shabazz Muhammad investigation.
Oh, yeah.
People, you know, saying things they maybe shouldn't be saying on airplanes, you know. Then you have, you know, the whole investigation going on in Miami. Then Oregon has a number of recruiting violations, and they don't even get so much as a slap on the wrist. So I think there's kind of a lot of inconsistency in what their rulings are, and it's causing them to lose a little bit of credibility. And I think we're seeing that, you know, maybe in the next 15, 20 years, something like the NCAA maybe won't exist because, frankly, chancellors are probably fed up, and there's been a lot of inconsistency. And, you know, for all intents and purposes, Shabazz Muhammad might have been out for the entire year, but because something was said that shouldn't have been said on an airplane, you know, he was reinstated and he was allowed to play his all Pac-12 season. So, it was definitely not their year. Kevin, what's your prediction with this case? I know there's still a lot that's up in the air, but what do you see happening?
Well, I mean, I know the NCAA probably has, like, most insane lawyers ever that are coming, going, and protecting him on this. And it's such a big deal. I mean, obviously, I think the players have a legitimate gripe and a legitimate legal complaint about other people profiting off of their work. But the whole bureaucracy of the NCAA and how entrenched that is in society and whatnot, it's hard to imagine there being a huge overhaul in that,
right?
Although I think it needs to happen. I'm just not sure, really. I feel like something's going to happen where O'Bannon's kind of going to win, but it's not going to result in a huge overhaul.
Right, and I think eventually we will see a stipend system put in place. I think the scholarship shortfalls that exist kind of, you know, have been brought to the forefront, and there are at least a number of schools that are willing to potentially cooperate with this. So I think that's something we will see in the future. But Kevin, good talk on this. We'll take a quick break, and we'll be right back with more Out of Bounds on Daily Bruin Radio. I let it fall. Hey, everybody. We're back on Out of Bounds on Daily Bruin Radio, and we'll get to a segment that we've been just loving in the past couple weeks here, and that is Approach the Bench. And with that, we will bring out Daily Bruin sports reporter Jason Dranch.
All right. So for Approach the Bench this week, how this is going to work, I'm going to introduce the topic, and then Andrew and Kevin are going to debate it, and I'm going to pick the winner. And so the topic for this week is, so it was announced today that former Butler coach Brad Stevens is skipping town and signing a 6-year, $22 million contract to coach the Boston Celtics. You know, UCLA reached out to him during their process before they hired Steve Alford. Did Brad Stevens make the right move?
Andrew, I'll let you take this first.
Okay, thank you so much. I think the question was, did Brad Stevens make the right move?
Right.
Brad Stevens absolutely made the right move. I think he was just looking potentially for a situation that was beneficial to him. I think maybe there was a certain part of him that thought that heading to a UCLA basketball program was more pressure than he and his family wanted, and that, you know, his task was going to be rebuilding something that was broken in UCLA's recruiting relationships and, I guess, its team in general. But with the Celtics, I guess he still gets something broken, but at least it's an opportunity to coach at the next level, and he's progressing to some extent, both financially and in the caliber of players that he's coaching. My hope for him is that Rajon Rondo comes back and that, you know, the team really kind of rallies around him. He's the youngest coach in the NBA, rather, even younger than Jason Kidd, who was just signed on as the coach of the Nets. But I think it's the right move for him, especially moving forward. And the Celtics organization really is going to understand that it's going to take some time for this team to build. It's not going to just be done overnight, especially with Garnett and Pierce and Doc Rivers out the door. So,
yeah, I definitely agree. I mean, that's kind of the obvious choice to make. We have a storied program like the Celtics that has a front office that's committed to succeeding and stuff like that. You got to make that leap. As great as Jobby did at Butler, I think it's too big of an opportunity to pass on. I also agree Rondo would really benefit Stevens from coming back, because, or if he came back, it would benefit Stevens, just so he has I mean, he's done a great job at Butler at building, getting the most out of players that maybe weren't as physically enough and as talented as opponents. He still brought them to, like, the Final Four twice in, I don't know, 5 years or something. So I think that having someone like Rondo there that's experienced, that knows the game, that's talented enough, it would be hard to start from scratch just without him. So I think it's not going to show right off the bat that he's doing a good job, because the Celtics are going to be terrible. But I think it's definitely a good hire. It'll be interesting to see how he and Kidd, as you mentioned, do. They're both starting fresh, and it'll be interesting to see what's the better thing. But yeah, I definitely think it was a good idea for Stevens to go.
All right, well, you know, it definitely sounds like Boston is going to be tanking in the conversation with Andrew Wiggins and guys like that for next year's draft. And, you know, maybe they even trade Rondo. But to get to the point of declaring a winner, I'm going to have to go for a tie for this week. Your argument.
I'm crushed. I still have no victories on my record, so this is just crushing for me, Jason.
Sorry, maybe next time. Argue better.
Maybe next time. I should have thrown in that he was a Gordon Hayward heave away from winning an NCAA title, but it escaped me at the moment.
That could have been the
tiebreaker.
I don't know what the word.
But Kevin, I don't know if you're watching this past Thursday. I know you were, because I wrote an article for you. But the NBA draft took place, and a particular UCLA basketball player by the name of Shabazz Muhammad was selected with the number 14 pick in the draft. The pick initially belonged to the Utah Jazz, but Muhammad's signing rights have been traded to the Minnesota Timberwolves, where he will play alongside former Bruin Kevin Love. It was going to be Malcolm Lee, but Malcolm Lee was dealt to your Golden State Warriors. So
not exactly. He's at Phoenix now. We dumped him.
Oh, wow. God, that was quick. But anyway, Muhammad will be playing in Minnesota. Muhammad, of course, averaged 17 points per game in his freshman season and led UCLA to an NCAA tournament appearance. But what was your impression of, I guess, Muhammad's drafting position, and why did he drop?
I was a little surprised he actually went into the lottery. Everything I was hearing was saying he wasn't going to go for another few picks. I was saying, like, maybe 17 or 19 as options for him. I think he dropped. I mean, obviously, he was ranked the number one prospect a year ago. Everyone thought if he didn't even play at all, he'd still be
right.
The number one pick.
They were saying that he was the only NBA-ready player in his draft class, and that was, of course, before Nerlens Noel reclassified. But it seems like he almost lost out by playing this year. And had he been suspended the entire year, there was so much hype surrounding him that just based on his workouts, if he really would have geared himself up for his workouts and just would have gone to Santa Barbara, then maybe he would have been better. But there's also something to be said for, you know, him facing that adversity and realizing that maybe, you know, he needed to separate himself from his dad and learn that, you know, you can't just go left and score on people all day.
There's more to basketball than going left.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
And maybe facing that adversity will do something for his game in the future. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole thing that you mentioned, like his dad kind of talking for him and stuff, and he's been saying a lot during the whole pre-draft interview that he wants to start speaking for himself and separate himself from his family, kind of, because there's a whole scandal with his dad speaking him as having a wrong age or something, and then his dad now under house arrest and all this stuff, and he's kind of wants to separate himself from that, which I think that's definitely a good idea to do that, but at the same time, he's kind of passing the blame for a lot of the mishandled stuff that happened to him off to his parents. I mean, he obviously knew that stuff was going on. You don't have someone with his profile that doesn't know that his dad is telling people that he's a year younger than he is.
Right.
So he needs to take some responsibility for that. But I think, he's trying to act more maturely, and there's no way that's going to hurt him unless he messes up a lot. But, I mean, I think that's definitely going to help him grow as a player and a person.
Right, and there's something to be said that he still, regardless of the fact that his dad falsified his age, he was the one who was carrying around a 20-year-old driver's license and could have stopped it day one by saying, hey, look, guys, I'm 20 years old. Like, this is not a big deal. But in addition to Muhammad, Larry Drew II, whose dad is now the coach of the Milwaukee Bucks, he will be playing for the Miami Heat Summer League team. Do you think he has a shot of making the roster, possibly?
For Miami Heat, I'm not sure. Larry Drew is a very ball-dominant and pass-first kind of guy, which the Heat don't really need. I think the Heat, if Liv Drew was more of a shooter first, and he could, like, stretch the floor with a three-point shot, I could see it, but I don't think his skill set's really something Miami needs. So maybe on a different team, but definitely not Miami.
Yeah, I think there's potential that if he plays well in the Summer League team, and I don't think Mario Chalmers is going to be making any visits to Summer League games, that he's really going to get the opportunity to play. There's always scouts at those games, and maybe some team takes a look at him and says, you know, we could really use a backup point guard, a sixth man that comes in when our, you know, second unit is in, and maybe, you know, he has a ceiling. I'm not saying he has a ceiling of a Tyreke Evans, but maybe he has a ceiling of a guy who could score 10 points a game and come in when the starting point guard's out. I don't think on a team like Miami, you have LeBron handling the ball a lot of the time. He's a point forward, and Chalmers obviously is the point guard, but yeah, there's really not a whole lot of opportunity for a player who really likes to run and really only discovered shooting halfway through this past season. So I think if he gets a shot down and if, you know, he catches a scout's eye, then there's a potential. You're right.
Yeah, I mean, I don't see him as Tyreke. I see like AC Law the third or something.
Right.
Where, I mean, it's not, maybe he's possibly an NBA player. I don't know.
Yeah, he's a role guy or a guy who plays in Turkey.
He has a chance of making. He definitely has the talent. It's just finding the right fit and if people see him.
Yeah. And do you think the one and done system really has done UCLA in the past? And do you think it will continue, or do you think Shabazz Muhammad should have stayed another year?
The one and done system for some programs, you look at Kentucky, I think it works for them because they're consistently getting these good players, and even if they're losing them, they're getting people to replace them. UCLA, like, I think the past one and done players, you have Kevin Love, Drew Holiday, and now Shabazz. For Kevin Love, it kind of works because he got them to the Final Four, but I think once he left, UCLA kind of, their programs, like elite status kind of left with them.
They really kind of tanked
after really great
point.
Since. And Shabazz didn't do a lot to help them. So I don't think UCLA is the type, at least under under Howland, he didn't have the right system in place for them to succeed that way. I don't know how Alford's going to play. So there's a possibility it could work for them there. But as for Shabazz, I feel like he probably didn't have much to gain from staying. He's not like super rough. He doesn't have like a raw game where he needs to develop his skills. It's just that he has limitations that aren't really going to improve by staying another year here. So he might as well cash out while he can.
Yeah, and it seems like UCLA is almost trying to pick up the pieces now that Shabazz is gone and trying to figure out where guys go. They're still trying to figure out a position for Kyle Anderson. And, you know, guys like Kyle Anderson, depending on how well Kyle Anderson does, he could go in the draft next year. Jordan Adams, I think, you know, if he stays in shape and he shows people that he's really committed to working out and improving his defensive game, he's already a long defender. He has the hands for a defender, but he just needs the body and kind of the quick footwork. But I think those are guys that could potentially go next year. I don't think Levine's ready, but if you could get a guy that, you know, is a 4-year player like a Lorenzo Motta or like a Darren Collison, that does wonders for a program because you have a consistency year in and year out, and you're not having to continue to find these guys every single year. And we saw that did Kentucky in because they had this amazing team that won a national title, but you know, they bring in these new hot recruits that don't really know what they're doing yet. They're the best player on their team in high school, but when they're all told to play together, you know, it really is a different story. So I think if you have that consistency, then it's really going to do wonders for them in the end. So,
yeah, I definitely agree with that. I mean, Kentucky, again, the veteran presence, there's something to be said for that. There's, if you just think about it, it's strange just with the whole one-and-done thing, how it's better sometimes to recruit someone that's good but not great. Because even though they might not have the same impact in the game, they'll be there for longer, so they have a more impact on the program. So it's just a strange balance you have to find when you're recruiting, I think.
Yep. All right, Kevin. Well, we'll move in quickly to a preview on UCLA football. Of course, Pac-12 Media Day, which I will attend. I believe it's at Universal Studios, so I'm really pumped for that. That's in 3 weeks. We have fall camp, of course, starting August 4th. So San Bernardino, that's going to be quite hot. I'm excited for that. I don't know that my body is or that my my deodorant is, but you know that's a different story. But I don't know. I can't believe I just said that. But anyway, the football season is closer than we might think. In your mind, what's the marquee matchup that's coming up for UCLA?
They have an interesting schedule because just looking at it, they have a pretty realistic chance of winning. Like their minimum seems to be like a 9-win season. Just looking at it, things go disastrously. So I think an interesting game could be Stanford on October 19th.
Right.
You have a rematch of the last two games of the year last year, which were the Pac-12 title game was really close. You have Brett Hundley and Kevin Hogan, quarterbacks both improving in their second years. I know Stanford lost some defensive players, so I'm not sure if they'll be quite as dominant. I mean, they're always going to be because they're a great program. They have great linemen and whatnot. But I think it's going to be a lot more of an even match this year. I think that could be a really interesting game.
Yeah, I'm looking for, obviously, the rematch in Nebraska. You have UCLA going into an environment that's not necessarily easy in Lincoln, Nebraska. They're going to be, you know, 75, 80,000 screaming Nebraska fans that don't necessarily like the fact that they lost their first game of this or their second game of the season last year. Of course, going up to Autzen and playing in Oregon is going to be an incredibly difficult task for UCLA. They still have DeAnthony Thomas, who tweets in all caps for some reason. I don't know why.
Does he?
Yeah, he does. I check it out sometime. And then, of course, the Stanford matchup that you mentioned. There's still question marks as to whether Washington will make a return with Keith Price. I don't even know if he's going to be the starter. Arizona State's kind of a question mark out west, or back east, I guess, from us. But, you know, there's never any knowing how well they'll do. But I guess Utah and Arizona are kind of wins you can kind of check off already. But USC, as well, is still looking for a quarterback. So there are a lot of question marks on the schedule. It really just depends on how, I guess, how consistent the run game for UCLA is, I think, because you're going to have defenses that are just going to key in on Hundley if they can't find a guy that can run downhill and get you the 4 or 5 yards you need per down. But, you know, there's a lot that's up in the air. I think they're at least an 8-win team, but we'll see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot to be answered in that fall camp, running back situation and whatnot, and secondary and whatnot. Should be an interesting one.
Yeah, they're definitely be fine on linebacker, though. But Kevin, any plans for the 4th? It's almost the 4th of July right now. We've been in the studio so long.
Yeah, we have, 2.5 hours left?
It's yeah,
enough.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean,
we can just
sit around all day and not do anything.
Okay, sounds good.
Pretty exciting plans. How about you?
Maybe grilling some hot dogs and, you know, hanging out with the family. So, very fun, Kevin. Thank you so much for joining us via phone. Tell the family in Pleasanton we said hi. And
most definitely.
Yeah, for all of us here at Out of Bounds on Daily Bruin Radio, thanks so much, and we'll see you soon.